You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, made in harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume, drink responsibly.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome to Dyed Green on HRN. I'm Kate McCabe.
And I'm Max Sussman. On this week's show, we have our special guest, Danny Barry. Danny Barry is one of Ireland's most celebrated chefs and recently finished up a stint at the Wicklow Escape. She was the second female Irish chef to hold a Michelin star.
No, you know, one of the things that I was curious about that I wanted to ask Danny about is whether she believes there is a difference in food culture between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland because of, you know, the history of the conflict in the north, the lack of investment. I think that they're sort of on a different timeline than the Republic is. I was really curious to hear her perspective on this as somebody who, you know, not only grew up there, but is at the top of her game in the culinary world.
What did she say about that?
Well, you'll have to listen to the episode to find out.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Before we spoke to Danny, you and I had this conversation about what happens when a chef gains a Michelin star and how that kind of changes the climate of the restaurant and maybe, you know, because it is so competitive and because those stars are so coveted, perhaps the culture of the restaurant shifts a little bit too, because once you have a star, you have a single focus towards trying to maintain that star or gain even more stars for your restaurant. And so, you know, it's just interesting to talk to chefs who have that experience to see how they're able to do that, but still maintain a certain atmosphere and guest experience.
Yeah, I think, I think like a customer thinks that, well, that the more Michelin stars you have, the simply the better the food and the better the experience is going to be. But it's interesting to talk to people on the chef side that there's not necessarily such a clear linear relationship there. Getting stars is about a lot of things, and a lot of it is, as what we talked about, a lot of it is just purely about consistency. And that doesn't necessarily match up with someone who wants to cook in micro seasons, for example, where, you know, you're getting some produce that the season might only last 2 weeks, and that's enough time to come up with a dish that you might like, but perhaps it's not enough time to come up with a dish that's like the Michelin inspectors are looking for. And so it actually pushes you away from wanting to change the menu, away from wanting to come up with new dishes, and towards this more routine way of doing things. It was a really interesting discussion to talk to somebody who's at that point in their career where they've achieved so much. And obviously right now it's like a really difficult time. As we talk about in the show, it's kind of always a difficult time for chefs and for restaurant owners. But right now it is one of those moments where a lot of people are wondering what they should do next, and wondering if the way that they did things in the past is a way that makes sense for them to go in the future. And so I think it was a really interesting moment to catch, to be speaking with her.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's such a critical time for restaurants all over the world, but, you know, we spoke to Danny about, there's a restaurant that we have been to in the past that just announced it was closing a few days before we spoke to her, because the cost of their energy had risen by 42%, which is just, when you think about how slim the margins are for running a restaurant, That's just really incredible. It makes you wonder how restaurants are going to be forced to change in response.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's getting tougher and tougher, but at the same time, you still have people that are really passionate about cooking, really passionate about providing a space of community, and also about mentoring people that are coming up and want to figure out how to make their way in the industry. So people will still be doing these things. It's just going to be really interesting to see how it changes, what develops, like you were saying. Thank you all so much for listening. If you love the show, please follow us on Twitter. We're at Dyed Green Pod, and please share the show with your friends. We love to get feedback from our listeners. So if you've got any thoughts or comments or anything at all you want to share with us, you can also email us at dyedgreen@heritageradionetwork.org.
We are also on Instagram at Bog and Thunder.
Yeah. Thanks all for listening and enjoy the interview.
Well, thank you so much for coming on Dyed Green. Really appreciate it.
I'm sorry it took so long to get me here. I don't really.
You're very busy. That's great, right?
Yeah, I suppose it is good. Yeah. I have to turn you up, but yeah.
Cool. Well, we're really excited to have finally found time where we can all chat and to hear about everything that you have going on. So hopefully we'll get to talk about that too.
Great. Yeah. Well, it's, we're about to go into a very busy summer, which is nice after the last 2 years, especially, you know. Last year, things kind of opened up a bit, and I was down in Wicklow, and it was, you know, people were starting to come out, but it wasn't like a normal, like, tourist season or anything. Like, there didn't seem to be the same sort of energy. And definitely, like, even last week with Taste of Dublin, you know, just to see all those people out again, there's a huge appetite for being out this year, which is great.
Awesome.
So if we could start out going a little bit into your origin story as a chef. You began working in kitchens as a porter when you were only 14. Were you actively interested in becoming a chef when you were that young, or was that something that you grew into because of your experience in the kitchen?
No, at that age, no, it wasn't. That wasn't a career decision. That was just, I think, a mixture of my parents wanting me to be out of the house and me just wanting to start to work. When I was 15, not 14, that sounds like it might have been illegal. but yeah, it was just like a local restaurant. And typical kitchen porter duties, washing up, maybe peeling potatoes, washing salad leaves, things that the chefs didn't really want to do or had time to do, those kind of things. And then I was there a couple of years while studying still at school. And then we do A-levels here in the north of Ireland, and that's about 17, 18, and you choose to go, you know, what you're going to do at university and what your kind of next step is. And for me, I just didn't, you know, I just wanted to own a restaurant because that's what I liked working in, and I thought this will be cool. And there didn't seem to be any, like, degree courses that, like, put me in that direction. I went to an all-girls convent school, and you were very much, you know, put in the path of teacher or nurse or, you know, law, if you, you know, so that was kind of where that was going. So I just asked my parents, you know, could I leave and could I go to catering college? And they said, you know, okay, you can go for 1 year. I think they assumed she'll get bored or this will not last and she'll want to go back to school. That was, yeah, it's probably like 20 years ago now. So I haven't gone back. So that's how I started. And then catering college here where I live in, like, Newry, was like my first kind of steps into, like, training as a professional. And then while I was doing that, the kitchen I worked in, they helped encourage me, and I would then be running maybe like the pastry section, you know, for the weekends and stuff, and just taking on more and more responsibility. And then they encouraged me to move to the bigger city, like Belfast, to go and work in a Michelin starred restaurant, because they were like, well, if this is what you want to do and you're so young, you should really try and get in at a high level, you know, as young as possible. And then you can kind of work out what level you want to work at. So, yeah, I was really encouraged from then, you know, to follow this path. And then probably after about 4 years of working in Dean's in Belfast, you know, which did have the Michelin star restaurant upstairs, and as well, like, a busy brasserie downstairs, then I kind of started to learn more about food itself. And I think that's probably when my interest in actual, you know, cooking really developed. And in food and in produce and, you know, getting to taste things and try things and cook with different that I just had never seen before.
I'm curious, you know, restaurant kitchens have traditionally been like very male dominated spaces. So I'm wondering, once you decided that that was the industry that you wanted to go into, did you have any female chefs or any mentors that you looked up to at the time?
So at the time, there was a program that was on television, and it was Angela Hartnett, who had been a chef for Gordon Ramsay, and they were opening a restaurant in the Connacht Hotel. And this like was a BBC documentary very much focused around, you know, her and that this was going to be her new baby after working for Gordon for a while or whatever. And so I do remember that like as sticking out in my mind, you know, as seeing somebody who was very present and very strong and, you know, as a female chef to look up to. But day to day, no, I probably would have been the only female in the kitchen in most of my first jobs. But I was very encouraged by everybody around me as well, you know, but no, there certainly wasn't that, certainly not to the extent that there are now. Like there, we have lots more female head chefs, you know, in Ireland, especially. This is, you know, this is almost 20 years ago. So it's, we've come on a bit, probably have more to do, but you know.
Do you feel like that's a role that you play now or that you want to play now for younger women coming up in kitchens or in restaurants in general?
I would like to, you know. I certainly try to do things that, you know, maybe some things that I wouldn't really be comfortable doing and putting myself forward for, just so that, you know, other young females do see you. You know, I do think visibility is important, and speaking about your experiences are important. Listening to other female chefs' experience is also very important. So, you know, I would like to be able to, you know, mentor a younger female chef or like inspire somebody. I mean, that would be, it'd be awesome if somebody thought that that's what you did.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the moment where you, or the time where you said that, you know, you started getting more into food and that's when you realized that you wanted to pursue it. Can you talk more about that? Was there like an ingredient or a dish or a smell or a technique or something that was, you know, happening around then that you can really point to as that moment that kind of sucked you in?
Well, yeah. When I began working in Dean's, it was the first time I had seen, you know, like stock pots, like massive pots of stock be made. And Michael would have made a stock for every dish. So there would have been a beef one, a really, roast chicken one, a shellfish one. And I still love making stocks and sauces now. Like, I think that's my favorite section in a kitchen. So that certainly, you know, stood out to me then. Just the smell of the mirepoix, even roasting down, and, you know, the bones and everything, and the reverence that this pot was being skimmed and, you know, starting with like massive pots and being reduced the whole way down. So I used to love that process and I still do, especially like, you know, making them shiny and, you know, clarification, things like that. You know, I just like, I love, and like, there's such a, it's such a skill to have been shown. And then I suppose other things were just the kind of produce we were using. I had worked in like a very local, you know, very rural traditional restaurant, and Dean's, you know, at that time, was very trendy to be important in like globe artichokes, Jerusalem artichokes, things that we didn't grow here then, which now we do. But I wouldn't have seen before, and just getting to prepare things like that just sparked an interest in like different foods. And then that's what encouraged me probably to go traveling then to, you know, to kind of see more of that sort of thing.
I know that you did a lot of work overseas. Is there a particular country that has had more influence on your cooking?
Spain probably. Had the most influence, especially on the use of like the whole animals, especially like, and you know, when I was in Valencia, we were going to the market and, you know, buying things like tripe and things just to cook. I had never really cooked with things like that before, and like a lot of offal, and it was really popular, you know, it was everywhere. So I really like that, and as well the way they make their sauces and things. I love Spanish cooking. And I suppose the first place I went to was Australia. So that probably has influenced the way I would organize and set up the kitchen more than the foods itself. You know, a lot of things we would have worked with in Australia, you know, we wouldn't get here, like barramundi and things like that. But it just shows you like when you're in a country, you know, if you use the local things that are around you, like you just, it's such a good experience for everybody, the people who work in your kitchen and for the diners, you know. So I just try and use that as much now with what I do.
Do they have a different way of setting up kitchen in terms of like the hierarchies and, or even making, you know, doing the line and the pickups and everything?
Yeah, well, when I was there, it was very, it was like a real apprenticeship model. So in the kitchen I worked in, we had first year, second year, third year apprentices. And they were given different responsibilities, you know, as their years progressed. And they were paid, you know, according to that. So you would see a job advertisement and it would be looking for a third year apprentice, you know, and that could tell you kind of what level that that person would be at. Whereas here, I think we're just always, well, we're constantly looking for chef de parties. But sometimes that can mean, depending on how big or small the kitchen team is, a chef de party can mean different things in different kitchens. I don't think this is, rigid, like, you know, it's as regimented as a, you know, really as a brigade. It's kind of coming away from that. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I think there was definitely a big focus on the kitchen that I worked in Australia on training the junior ones. And if you were the second year apprentice, you know, you were expected to look after the first year apprentice and so on and so on.
I feel like there's always this weird tension between like, you're supposed to train new people, but then there's always this kind of weird competitive environment that like doesn't always actually encourage that behavior to happen. So that's really interesting to hear of that's built in like that.
Yeah, it can be. And I think kitchens, you know, I don't know. Well, I think they certainly were competitive when I started working in and you wanted to move on to the next section. So you're kind of always watching that chef ahead of you, you know, to be like, if I get in earlier, now if I get set up, I'll be able to do your bit as well or whatever. I think now with the staffing situation, it's probably not as competitive as it was. You probably just try and encourage all your team to be able to take part in everything that's going on. I think that's it's probably a better model moving forward for hospitality as opposed to the rigid structure of a brigade environment. Because when you don't have the bodies, those positions don't be filled.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about staffing shortage and how that's impacting, say, how you cook food in general or how you run your kitchen?
Yeah, well, before COVID, we had a staffing shortage in Ireland for chefs and for skilled chefs as well. It's not just a staff shortage, it's a skill shortage as well. Because the training schemes and stuff aren't, you know, there's not enough people joining them, maybe. Not enough people coming in at that level to the industry and staying in it. So staff retention is a big problem. Certainly I know, you know, everything I do would be focused around having a small team and seeing how much I can do myself, you know, and what bits I need filled. So I think people have kind of gone towards that, you know, a smaller team. If you're doing savory, you would hire somebody to do pastry, you know, plus some juniors, you know, that kind of setup. I think, you know, the industry needs to change to make it more welcoming for staff. The long hours and things and the reputation for not being paid properly certainly were before COVID, we were struggling. Now that people have had some time and have stepped back and like everybody's reassessed their work-life balance and what they want to do in all industries, and they're certainly not rushing back to hospitality, you know, and it's a shame. We've seen how vulnerable the sector was, you know, that it could just be closed down. Which obviously was very jarring for most people, and especially like me, who you kind of went into hospitality, and I've worked all around the world and been able to get jobs in kitchens and on boats, and you know, I've never ever thought you'd be out of work, and then we all were, you know. So that certainly, you know, has given people some food for thought, excuse the pun. But at the same time, in Ireland, this is probably one of the most exciting times to be working in hospitality and working in food. I mean, our producers and our restaurants and everything have never been better, I don't think. We have a real diversity, you know. So before, when I left Belfast to go to Australia, and even when I left to go to work in England, you know, younger chefs don't have to do that now. You could be from Belfast and you could move to Dublin and work in a two-star or three-star, or you could go to West Cork and work in a one star, you know, so you could travel around Ireland now and gain really good experience in lots of different things, whereas you weren't able to do before. So it's a shame that it is that we are struggling to get staff and young chefs and front of house as well. And I think we just need to start making some changes. And I say we, because we say like the industry needs to change, but like we are the industry, I suppose, you know, like no one's going to do it for us. So I think we all just kind of have to do our bit and hopefully that will cause bigger change.
It's such an interesting contrast to have it be a time where there's so much exciting happening in Irish food. But like you said, maybe the traditional ways that people would have gotten involved in that, say coming up as a chef de partie, aren't so appealing anymore. So do you think people are getting into food in different ways and say not coming towards a restaurant as the way to get involved in food, but maybe doing other projects and that kind of thing?
I would agree with that. You know, we've seen a lot of talented people who have diversified into, you know, bakery, you know, making breads, artisan chocolates, the farming as well. You know, some people have left the industry because they actually have got really into growing vegetables and herbs and, you know, looking at things in that way, you know, that all contribute to a really interesting, great food culture, which, you know, would be brilliant for Ireland to have. But yeah, the restaurant kitchens doesn't seem to, you know, they're not as appealing then when you can, you know, work for yourself or work outside. Get evenings off, you know, that kind of thing. So I can see why people, especially someone who's very talented and very skilled at that, you know, would go into something like food production as opposed to trying to survive this kind of climate we're experiencing now with the restaurants.
You touched on this a little bit a few minutes ago, but on this show, we talk a lot about perceptions of Irish food and in particular how limited Americans' perception of food in Ireland is and a little bit antiquated tends to be, you know, beef and potatoes. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Irish food culture has changed since you became involved in restaurants and maybe just talk a little bit about what you find most exciting about Irish food right now.
Yeah. So, well, firstly, I mean, our beef and potatoes are great.
Yeah. No disrespect. Yes. Yeah.
And I think it works quite well for us here, you know, because I have found when we do have American visitors, they're so, you know, they're so blown away when they do eat here, and they can't tell you enough about how many good restaurants we have or like what they ate, because I think there is that perception that, you know, it will be plain, maybe bland, you know, maybe that's the, so it's good for us because, you know, you've kind of undersold, but you've over-delivered. So they're always really, really happy guests, which is what you want. I think definitely, you know, a lot of chefs, cooking in restaurants now or that have opened restaurants recently have all worked abroad. So I think that kind of, you know, chefs having traveled and gone away to experience something and then bring it home to where they're from. And I think as well, when you do travel, you realize the things that we have that are really good here, you know, and that we do have really good beef and dairy and, you know, our seafood is like world class. And when you've seen what other, you know, other countries, other cultures, other cuisines, how they use that, and then you take that back to what you do yourself, it makes it like a real, you know, I guess it's like really authentic, you know, it's really kind of genuine. And if you go to any kind of coastal town now, they're, you know, from something really casual, you know, even like a, you know, a little shack on, you know, just serving really good fish and chips or, you know, fish tacos and things, to maybe like a close by starred or Michelin awarded restaurant, they're all using the same produce, you know. And we really champion our producers, I think, now, and we all really want to support them. And it's a small enough island that a lot of chefs really, you know, there's a good network of chefs as well that all help each other out. And if somebody hears or of a really good if somebody hears of somebody doing something really good, they want to tell other people, you know, so people will share and people will, you know, send you a DM and say, have you tried this, you know, you must get some, you should put it on your menu. And that kind of builds up a really nice community within the industry that I think the customers and the guests definitely reap the benefits from.
Seems like there's this evolution of people being, you know, and this has happened in different places too, but in Ireland, of the best restaurants going from, say, being known for cooking French food or food with a lot of French technique to like people being really, really excited about Irish ingredients and things that are a little bit more indigenous or more native to the country. So it seems like there's a really big shift that's happening. Do you think that have you seen that in your career, and has that been reflected in your cooking?
For me personally, I've seen a massive shift towards like using, you know, local, and as you say, like what grows here, like, you know, more like foraging and like our wild herbs and things that we definitely didn't use before. I said when I worked for Michael Dean, you know, a lot of our veg order that week would have came from France. You know, we imported a lot of, you know, because it was fine dining, you felt like you had to have globe artichokes, salsify, you know, high-end ingredients. And I think Michael always had a good balance of both, but like there's definitely now I wouldn't, you know, import any of those things, you know, myself. I would look to see what has been grown here first and what we can do with the cabbages and the beetroots and the things that people are growing around us that really suit the climate here. Things like seaweed, you see a lot more on menus now, and sea herbs and stuff like that from the coastal, you know, as opposed to using like where it would have been green beans before, all the way from Kenya or whatever. So I like that is happening. You know, I think it's great. I do think like it has certainly influenced the way I cook. You know, that's what I like to use. And even if, you know, for like a game season, if you think of where the deer live, for example, and that they eat, you know, corn and berries and, you know, the trees and the stuff in the woodland around them, and you kind of use that in the dish, you know, it makes for a really nice story, but it also just makes sense because it tastes good, and that's the kind of stuff that they go with. And the seasonal thing, I guess you hear it quite often, but like I think a lot more now you do see menus change, whereas, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, you know, the menus, you know, didn't really change that much from season to season. You know, you could have really guessed sometimes what was going to be on a menu. But now you see a lot more chefs into like fermenting and pickling and preserving those seasons and then using them later on in the year, which I love to do as well. And it makes a really interesting kind of, it gives you just a more interesting larder as well to choose from, you know, and it's cost effective too. So that always helps.
In your opinion, are there any differences between the food culture in the North and the South?
I would say there are. I think in the South of Ireland, well, there's a lot more, you know, it's a lot bigger. And I think it's not so Dublin centric anymore either. You know, I think like Galway is a great city for food. Cork is a great city for food, you know, Waterford and things. So I think it's definitely spread out that there are a lot more interesting things happening in food outside the big cities. In the country as a whole, a lot of us north and south would use a lot of the same suppliers because, you know, it is that close, really. We are able to, so we definitely benefit from that. I think the north is just younger. I think, you know, it's just maturing now, certainly as a food culture. We have some amazing restaurants and amazing producers with brilliant produce, but for so many years I think we've just exported and we haven't really used it. I think even ourselves as like chefs or even restaurant owners have assumed that people in the north of Ireland still want just big plates of like hearty food, and they're not, you know, willing to try new things, but that's changing now as well. I think we're definitely evolving in the north. We're probably that little bit behind the south, to be honest, but not in standards of anything, just in the amount of of what there is available. But it's certainly like, I'm trying to think what's the word, like punching above its weight, maybe, you know, like that kind of, you know, and certainly people come, they definitely don't, are surprised in a good way when they come to the restaurants and stuff here.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods that a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
HRN is home to transformative exchanges about food. We hope our diverse lineup of shows opens your eyes, educates, and empowers.
I spent 7 years working in the restaurant and bar industry, in front of house and back of house. And I just feel like Heritage Radio Network's content helps me feel so well connected to the other creators and chefs and restaurateurs and all the amazing things that they're doing. I still feel like I get to be a part of the kind of in team.
Join us during our summer membership drive by donating and becoming a member. Members play an essential role in keeping nonprofit food radio on the air. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member today. We thank you for your support.
Can you talk about like what it means to cook food at a Michelin level? What goes into that? And whether that was the direction that you always saw for yourself in terms of the type of food and the type of experience that you were providing to guests. And like, just kind of lay it out for the listener who really doesn't know what that means. And then I'm curious about whether that's something that you, whether that's a path that you want to continue down in terms of the style of food and experience, or whether your own personal style has evolved in a different way.
So I guess my first real kitchen job was with Michael, you know, so that was like an introduction into Michelin, and just even hearing about the guide and understanding what it was. And from then, every year that guide comes out, you know, I'm excited to see what's in it. I certainly choose restaurants by that guide. You know, it's a guidebook, and, you know, it does have its faults. I think some people will disagree with Michelin from time to time, but it's certainly the bar where everybody else follows. As a chef, I suppose it is kind of the holy grail. I traveled a lot when I was younger, so I would work somewhere and then go traveling and then move around to try and learn as much as I could. I don't think I was working towards, you know, being a Michelin star chef, but I just wanted to learn as much as possible. You know, I was just really hungry for it. You know, I just wanted, it wasn't even something that was planned or thought out. It was just, you know, it just naturally, I just like, oh, I really want to go there. So when I went over to England to work for Simon Rogan, and at the time, they now have a 3-star restaurant, Longclune, but at the time it had just got 2 stars. He was doing that farm to fork. You know, they had built their own farm in Longclune, and he was doing like really refined, elegant looking tasting menus, with a real focus to local, zero waste, sustain, you know, like foraging, preserving, all that. So I went, oh, well, I want to go and do that. And at the time I was working as a head chef, and we had won a Michelin bib, and I probably could have stayed in that environment, you know, and been very comfortable with what I was cooking. And I was still, you know, not ready to like stop learning. So I just wanted to go and see that. And then when I went to Cartmel, they had a sister restaurant, Rogan & Co., and I ended up being the head chef there for a while. And it was while I was there, Michael Dean had got in touch to say, would you come back to Belfast? I'm opening the restaurant again. He would have liked it to have gotten a Michelin star, but it wasn't the, you know, he wanted a nice restaurant again. He had closed it in a recession and they had focused on their more commercial offerings, and he wanted something extra to add to the portfolio of restaurants he has. And it was like a homecoming in a way for me, you know, to go back to Michael, to show him everything I learned, and to run his kitchen for him. So I said, you know, I jumped at it then. When we opened, I mean, you know, it's a small dining room. It was tasting menu. I think if you do that kind of thing, you can, you know, it looks like a Michelin star restaurant, or it looks like it would go that way. And while being in Simon's and having over in Rogan & Co., and having had Michelin inspections and things like that, and just kind of being on their radar, you know, you do fall into like onto a path that's, you know, that is the direction I started to go in. It wasn't on purpose really. Until that stage, you know, it wasn't like, but there was, I suppose, a feeling of like recognition for all the work that I had done, for everything I'd learned and that kind of thing. And you do feel like, oh, well, actually, this would be nice to be acknowledged, I guess, you know. So then once we got the star, you know, that kept me in a job if I'd wanted, because Michael was obviously happy. It changed the business overnight, you know, it changed the restaurant. We were busy then. It was great for Belfast because we got the star at the same time as Ox, and that was the first time there had been any Michelin stars in Belfast for quite a few years. So that really, you know, for the people of Belfast and the city, you could see that moved things on as well. So that was a really exciting time. So I was delighted to be a part of that. And it opened up a lot of opportunities for me to travel around Ireland doing pop-ups and just being at things and being involved in things that I probably wouldn't have if it hadn't been for that kind of recognition. So it was the best time, you know, for me. I really enjoyed it. And then I think there is, to work at a Michelin level, you know, every day it needs to be perfect. Everything needs to be perfect every day. There is a monotony to that kind of work, as well as obviously you do get to be creative and like we have full creative control over the menus, and you do get to come up with dishes and everything. But because you need to keep a certain standard, you're not, or I wasn't anyway, as flexible with changing things as much as, you know, because you do always kind of think, oh, well, you know, people expect, you know, there's expectations now with a Michelin star, and you don't want to put on something on your menu that you don't feel is the same as everything else. So it takes an awful lot more time to like change a menu as such, and you kind of just keep doing a lot of the same things. Well, I did, not everybody would treat that way. We had a really small team and a small kitchen, so we had to make it kind of work for everybody. But for me, it was all encompassing, you know, as a lifestyle as opposed to a job. And on my days off, I would be foraging for the restaurant, or I would be at an event or whatever. So it was really intense, like 3 years of doing that. And then I started to feel like it's maybe not sustainable as a lifestyle, like for myself to like be in charge of a 1-star kitchen that everyone's like, oh, what if they come in? What if, you know, that it's always this, you're at this kind of level. That it took up too much time, you know, and I just wanted to see how I can get more balance, you know, in my life, and not have to be there, you know, every day that it was open. Now, we had set up the restaurant to do that, as most do, you know, with like set days and set holidays and things. But you put a lot of demands on yourself and your own time to be able to do that, and also the people who work with you. And I had a brilliant team there, and you want like the best for them as well. So I feel like I'm at a stage now where I would really like to cook the food that I like, and which is in that style, but without placing too many demands on the people around me, you know, without expecting them to sacrifice just so much for something that was, you know, my dream or whatever, if that makes sense. So that's kind of where I am at the minute, you know, with kind of trying to weigh everything up. You know, my dream was always to open a restaurant. I still want to own a restaurant. It's probably the worst time to be trying to open a restaurant. But sure.
It's always the worst. It's always the worst time to
be. It's always the worst time. Exactly. That's it. But for me, restaurants are about more than Michelin stars. You know, a restaurant, you know, I really want somebody to come to my restaurant because they love the feel of the place and they feel like they're welcome and that they know that I'll cook them some nice food, or like that we're really trying to, you know, give them a good time as well as something really enjoyable, and that everybody who works there is happy and we're all treated properly and we're creative and we're, you know, enjoying it. So there's kind of a lot of things to take in now before, you know, you would go like, I want an accoladed restaurant.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I don't know how much of that is related to like everything that we've already talked about in terms of, you know, a lot of the changes that you described pre-pandemic that were kind of accelerated by the pandemic and now coming out of it, and people are a lot more focused on having that sort of balance and a lifestyle that allows them to achieve things. And they might be less interested in, you know, working 90-hour weeks and trying to. I thought the way you described it in terms of being monotonous was really interesting, because I think a lot of people would describe it as really strenuous and difficult. But I wouldn't think that repetitive and monotonous would be some of the problems with it. So I think, yeah, and I would say probably people want a little variation and maybe the excitement of putting a new special on the menu every once in a while. So I think it's really interesting, and it kind of ties into everything else we've been talking about and all the other changes that are going on.
Yeah, well, for me, I think, you know, up until COVID, I had been working full time in the industry, and anywhere I'd worked, it's possibly a minimum of 60-hour weeks, up right up to 90. So nobody, you didn't think about it, you know. I would have done 70, 80-hour weeks as a normal working week, you know, without thinking about it too much. And I think once people got so much time off and started cooking at home, they realize just how much time they spend in a kitchen for work purposes and not as much in their own. Well, I find anyway. And with Michelin and at the minute with restaurants at any level, actually, the margins are always so tight and you always want to do your best for food waste and things. But when you're trying to create something that's perfect every time, there's a lot of waste as well involved in that, which, you know, for me now, I would want to work a different way, as opposed to trying to get perfect, you know, round radishes or the square, you know, and just trying to use everything. In Dean's, we were lucky we had other kitchens and we all worked between ourselves. But I think if you were doing something like, you know, for yourself without all that kind of around you to be able to use, you know, I think we all have to start to look at things differently for like the future of food and the future of restaurants. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, the waste thing is so interesting, because people see the perfection and the perfect shapes and the, you know, exact precision of ingredients and don't really think about what happens to all the other parts of the fish, all the other parts of the veg, and how you achieve all that, you know?
Exactly. And as well, even for chefs themselves, when they come to work, you know, younger chefs, we have so much on Instagram now where we follow all these top restaurants, these high-end restaurants, and we look at their plates of food and we think, you know, we're trying to emulate that. And they maybe have 12 unpaid stagiaires somewhere, you know, picking tiny, tiny things down, which we can't do, you know. So it's not realistic. And as you say, once you see those pretty pictures and they look amazing, nobody thinks like, well, I wonder where everything else went, you know. and we have to find a way to use it all, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
especially if you're having, you know, now things are shifting, like, as you said, from say importing these vegetables from other countries to like using stuff that's grown by a farmer that is much closer to you, and you don't want to be getting all their stuff in and then like tossing half of it out, right?
No. Or getting all their stuff in and realizing none of it's the right shape and sending somebody, you know, out to get to order more stuff. You know, it's not, yeah, it's trying to use all that. But that's just at the minute my focus is on that kind of thing, trying to cook differently. I've definitely enjoyed, you know, cooking at home more than, you know, because I hadn't done it before really when I was at work. You know, you maybe cooked on a Sunday, but you don't cook a lot when you're a chef.
Well, you hear this, I mean, there's this stereotype of chefs that when they cook at home, it's like they just heat up like a hot dog or a pizza or something like that. So it's kind of cool that you still actually like cooking and that you still do it at home for pleasure.
Yeah, well, because it's unusual because you realize actually it can become, it's quite confronting to be like cooking at home or to be doing a pop-up in someone else's kitchen or doing something else and to not have all the kit, like all the gear, like no water bath, backpack machine, no packer jet. And then you have to start to think, whoa, hold on. Like, so then you go back to all your original training, you know, and you have to think of how you make these things as opposed to like, you know, when you have all that in place, you're just, you know, it's much easier really. Like, so you're kind of, I'm sort of relearning a lot of stuff.
That's awesome.
So did the restaurant that you were working at have to close because of the pandemic? I know that you spent some time at the Wicklow Escape recently. I'm curious as to how you sort of made your way down there.
So I had left Dean's a long time before that. And I was working in a restaurant outside in County Down called Blue House. And we had just opened Overwood there, which was, so Blue House is like an old country pub and there's a big traditional pub restaurant downstairs, and upstairs they used to have like a fine dining restaurant, and the owners wanted something a bit more casual, still quite high end, but so we put in a grill and we called it Overwood and we cooked everything on fire, and that's where I was before the pandemic. But I unfortunately lost my husband in October 2019, so I was out of work pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, and then had just kind of started to work again on different things like consultancy and doing pop-ups and just doing bits and pieces and just working for myself then, and some kind of TV appearances and a bit of media and food styling and just jobs. So yeah, just hustling really for the last almost 3 years. So down in Wicklow, Lisa had, I had seen her on Instagram, and she was looking to like kind of rebrand what the Wicklow Escape was and offer a new food package. And I had got in touch with her to see could I come down and see the place. And it's stunning. It has their own garden right in the Wicklow Mountains. Great suppliers, like a Wagyu beef farm just across the road, organic vegetables, Ballyhobbock sheep's cheese, like all these amazing producers in this small area. So it felt like something really like unusual and really special. And I was like, I could do with a move. So I went down to kind of set that up with Lisa. And I worked there for like 6 months until she, you know, got a chef then in place for that. So I still do some of that with Lisa, you know, on a consultant basis, but I'm not there full time. Does that make sense?
It's like really hard to imagine the tragedy of losing your husband. If it's something you're comfortable talking about, was that something that, like, how did that end up affecting your, where you are now in terms of your, like, did you decide to reevaluate your work in restaurants and other things? And did that lead to some of the changes that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, losing Will it's a game changer. You know, any plans that were made, everything's just, you know, gone. You literally, it's the literal feeling of having the rug pulled from underneath you. Will worked in hospitality as well. So Will worked front of house in a restaurant, and he had done for years and years. And we both worked loads. His health definitely suffered as a result, which is why, you know, it was very untimely, as you said, tragic that he is gone so soon. So you don't have a choice in that situation. When something like that happens, you just do reevaluate, you know. I think it's, you know, just to survive. When the life you were going to live no longer exists, in whatever way that happens to someone, you have to look at everything again. And you're really trying to rebuild. And with that, I suppose for myself, I don't want to repeat, you know, patterns that were maybe, you know, obviously unhealthy, or, you know, that weren't conducive to living a long and happy, healthy life. So yes, it definitely affects my decisions now all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. We wanted to ask a little bit about what's next for you and what sort of projects you're working on. I mean, we've had such a wide-ranging discussion about the past, and we should talk a little bit about the future. So
the future, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so currently I'm working with a company, well, a lady, it's just, there's three of us, it's not a company, but we're called Wild Dining. So you can find it on Instagram, Wild with an E. And Kathy's based in Fermanagh. And it's a pop-up event dining. Kathy's background is in like interior design, and she was a musician. So we always have beautiful styling, and there's always a musician. So it's kind of like an event. You buy a ticket, we go to different locations around Ireland and Northern Ireland and set up our tents and our tables and some fires. And we just cook everything outside where we can. And yeah, it's really good fun. I think there's been like a big lean towards outside dining with COVID and with not being able to go into restaurants. I think we've seen a lot more of our outdoor spaces just in generally, you know, people have visited more parks and local estates and things that they maybe just hadn't been to before. And we're still seeing that there's like an appetite for that. So it's great. So we're doing that all through the summer. Well, for as long as we can. So hopefully to the end of September, while the weather is good. And with that, we visit an area, we will try and use what's best in that area. So we look for local suppliers and things. Some of the estates we do the pop-ups on, they have their own beef and lamb and things like that. So we offer like set menus at that, and that we can showcase kind of the best of that area for that one, you know, one evening, one or two evenings. And then that's it. We just take it all down and we move on to the next one. It's certainly like, it's a bit like joining the circus. Because you're always traveling, but it's really good fun. It's been great for me. You know, I've been able to try things out, you know, in a much more casual environment, you know, than, you know, so you can play, you know, it's very creative and stuff. And I love cooking over fire anyway. It's funny how we've appropriated all this stuff that we used to have to do, but it's like, I can't have a water bath or Syrovac, so I'll just light a fire. But it's good. It's interesting. I'm still looking for, you know, a site for myself. I moved home from Belfast to County Down over the pandemic and stuff. And this is the area, like, it's just a lovely feeling being at home. And I would really like to open something around here. So I'm kind of just working towards that at the minute and doing bits and pieces until we get there.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've managed to create like a work environment that has everything that you were looking for, at least temporarily.
Just,
you know,
just
you're
no
outside,
stability.
You're moving around.
No stability at all.
Right,
but it's good. We'll get there. I work with a company in Ireland as well called Compass. They're like a large food service company, but they have just recently began to run a chef apprenticeship program. And like I was saying, you know, from my time in Australia and stuff, and like, I'm really interested in like training future generations of chefs and like seeing how we can do that. So I'm working quite closely with them to develop this program, which has been really interesting. We're going to try and take them out of the kitchen. So they work in things like, you know, they do massive conference events. They all work in the kitchens in like Google and Intel and stuff. So their kitchens are really good. Their clients are all pretty particular. You know, they have a really high standard of food offering. And so it's taking them out of the kitchen and going and visiting, you know, some of the suppliers that they use, just so that they can see the produce in their hands. We're going to get them planting some vegetables, harvesting some things, and, you know, to try and like take a more holistic approach to like the training, as opposed to just skills based in a kitchen, you know. To show them that there's different ways to work and like different things, like we'll do a fermentation class and things like that. So, and like some mindfulness and things like that, just so that they get like a whole approach to, you know, their training from like an early stage in their career. So it's really good. It's really fun. And it's really encouraging that we have apprentices on the program. So there are people willing to come in.
Yeah.
So, which is great. But they, you know, they work in kind of 9-to-5 kitchens and they, you know, they love it, you know, but the food can be just as interesting and creative and, you know, they can have the exact same ethos as a restaurant kitchen if they wish, you know, it's all the same. So it makes it better for everybody, really. Yeah. So there's that. So yeah, kept busy doing that.
You mentioned before that it's a really difficult time to be opening a restaurant right now. It seems like everywhere around the world. I'm curious about some of the issues affecting the North specifically. And we had heard recently that the ramen restaurant, Be a Rebel, is closing. I think that I heard that they said that their energy bill went up by 42% or something crazy like that. And so I'm curious, as someone who's currently looking for a space to open, and then also whether there are certain ramifications because of Brexit and the protocol in terms of being able to import some of the things that you need, or having an impact on staffing shortages, perhaps because of the laws about having EU employees. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you might be facing opening a spot in the North as opposed to in the south of Ireland.
Yeah. So firstly, yeah, really sad news about Be a Rebel. What Brian and his wife have created there has been like, that's been a big move for food culture in Northern Ireland. You know, like that was something really different and they've done so well. And that's such a shame to see somewhere like that close. Because yeah, of things like energy, yeah, like their gas bill. But we know like in restaurants, the margins are so tight. There is no space for a 42% rise in anything. Like that's just not going to be doable at all, you know. So people are having to make really tough decisions. Like I've heard in the last week, you know, of another couple of places that are kind of probably closing as well. So for myself, looking to open somewhere, it does seem a bit like, oh, are you just waiting for somewhere to close? Like, are you going to like run in at the end to be like, oh, we'll, you know, like we'll open this, it'll be fine. But that's why I'm kind of happy to take projects now, bits and pieces, just to see how everything falls. Brexit has certainly made a big difference in terms of hiring staff, and especially, you know, front of house. We would have had a lot of European staff, and in the kitchen porters, back of house, you know, people are kind of solely blaming the pandemic at the minute and saying, oh, people, you know, there's nobody wants to go back and work in kitchens. But they've actually, you know, it's actually Brexit has a big part to play in that. And we're seeing that in all areas of the service industries in Northern Ireland. Regards to the protocol, I really wouldn't like to comment. From anything I've seen, it makes sense for Northern Ireland to continue to treat it as it is. It's certainly more a political issue than business. You know, it's not, those decisions are coming from businesses that I've heard. You don't want anything, you know, ideally we'd be able to trade with the EU and the UK without any friction, you know, and that's kind of what has more or less been put in place for Northern Ireland. And I think we should be embracing that as much as possible and seeing the opportunity for, you know, potential like for businesses and for investment and using that to our advantage, as opposed to trying to, I don't know, rock the boat or, yeah, which is a shame. The political stability in Northern Ireland, it will be what helps Northern Ireland continue to thrive, as it has been in the last, you know, 20 years. And I've certainly seen the difference in, even in Belfast as a city, even in the visitors that come here, in the things that we're able to do, and like the businesses have been encouraged to open and have been successful, that we rely a lot on political stability to be able to do that. So that's just one thing. It's obviously an extra concern in the back of your head if you're doing anything in Northern Ireland, that you feel like, oh, are we gonna shoot ourselves in the foot here? And will we go back? I don't think so, because the majority of people who live here just want to live normal lives, you know, want to have good jobs and want their kids to stay here, you know, want to be able to bring up families here and, you know, to have opportunities for everybody. So I would really just like to see that continue. Hospitality and tourism in Northern Ireland has been so important, in especially in this last 5 years. Having things like Game of Thrones filmed here has brought so many visitors to Northern Ireland. And then they eat in our restaurants and stay in our hotels. You know, it's good for everybody. The golf, you know, we get a lot of golfers to visit Northern Ireland, and it's such a beautiful part of the world. You know, it's really accessible as a tourist. You know, you can fly into Belfast, but you can be in the North Coast within 2 hours. You know, it's, you can see everything on a short trip, and you can eat everything now as well. I just want to see that continue. Northern Ireland voted to remain in the European Union, so obviously that comes with its own arguments, that we've kind of been pushed in this direction against our will as such, and obviously where there is that, there will be pushback from people. So it's an interesting time. Energy prices and fuel prices and everything, anything that makes it tougher for people to do business is obviously going to affect a lot of people. So I would just like to see them get back into government and make decisions for people who live here, as opposed to, you know, putting their foot down over a protocol that doesn't actually seem to be affecting people as much as they're, you know, as is claimed. I don't think your identity to a flag is important when you can't feed your family or heat your house, really. So that's maybe enough about that.
So I guess I wanted to just follow up and ask about about what you see next. And if we could pretend like none of that stuff is going on. Yeah. And you could just envision the restaurant or the food project that you wanted to open next. Like, what would it look like? You know, what would the menu, like, would it be a tasting menu restaurant? Would it be a la carte? Would it be like, you know, super upscale? Would it be for families? Like, do you have some vision of what it is that you want to do next, or are you just kind of keeping things loose?
Probably keeping things quite loose just because of the way things are. But we do have, like, I come from a farm, and my younger brother has taken over the farm. So we do have that kind of land and stuff available where we, you know, I would like us to have our own, like, use stuff from our farm, whether it's vegetables or our own herd of cows and things like that. So that's definitely something I would like to be able to do. And but I really wanted to have like a neighborhood restaurant vibe. You know, I kind of want to know the people who come in. You know, I think the thing about restaurants, and I know for us growing up, there were restaurants that were really important to us as a family where we went for certain things, you know, and I think restaurants can play a really big part in a community that way. So that's kind of where the focus would be. I'd say I do like cooking over fire, so I would like that kind of style. Where it's really just great produce cooked really simply, loads of really good sides and things, you know, good sauces and good sides, you know, so quite casual, but good. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds amazing. Honestly.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Sounds great.
We'll be there.
Yeah.
100%. Right. Good. So in closing, we just wanted to ask you if there are any people in the food industry or restaurants or projects that are happening right now that you're particularly excited about, or that you think people should know about?
Yeah, so, well, a Taste of Dublin last week, I was very lucky. I was asked to help judge the Best in Taste Awards. So we got to taste like all the food from the food trucks that were there. And like, that's something they've really upped their game over COVID. Like, food trucks are, I mean, some of the standard, some of the food coming out of these vans was incredible. So there were a couple of great ones. Bahay, which is a Filipino based. So this guy Riggs, he's been working in restaurants in Dublin, and now he's bringing his own Filipino influences into his cooking. So everything he's learned in Ireland with the produce from here, and the dishes he grew up with, it's a really lovely match of all those cultures. And it's exactly where, like you just mentioned, like, that's exactly where the future of food is, and that's exactly where the future, you know, for Irish food is. So, and it was just delicious, like, just so good. And again, there was like the Salt Project. So they're quite similar to wild dining in that they move around the country and it's a very strict zero waste. Like they're using the whole plants and a lot of forage stuff and whatever local producers are around. But it's a really interesting story. Again, somebody who's kind of come out of restaurants because they want to see a more, like, they want to change the way they write a menu, basically, and how they approach cooking and coming up with a dish. So they're really interesting. Yeah, for sure. Again, I do think it's very exciting for Ireland at the minute. You know, I do. We've never had so many Michelin stars. And I think that constant like evolution of that standard just brings everybody else up with them. So I do think it will continue. You know, I just really hope that everybody survives and people continue to support the restaurants, you know, and that if the prices of food go up, that people realize that it's so that people can pay wages and so that people can, you know, survive. And it's not, nobody's making any money out of this really, you know, and that, you know, the guests and our consumers will like just continue to support them. Because it would be a shame after all that to see things go back to, you know, just people having to cut corners or people not paying staff properly and everything, just, you know, just to keep their doors open, you know, that would be an awful shame after how far we've come. And I think we have brilliant chefs and some really creative minds, and that shouldn't happen. It should just be continued, you know, the way it is from here, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Cool. Before we sign off, is there any, you know, we just always like to ask people if there's anything that we missed that we thought that you thought we should ask about or things that you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I've got myself in enough trouble, I'd say, with what you have asked. say no more.
That's kind of how I feel when I get interviewed. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, thank you so much. It was a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Yeah,
and
it was lovely to get speaking to you both. Yeah. I look forward to cooking you a big homegrown grass-fed beef steak someday.
Dyed Green is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Dyed Green is a project of Bog and Thunder, whose mission is to highlight the best of Irish food and culture through food tours, events, and media. Find out more at bogandthunder.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have any story suggestions, questions, or things you'd like to share in response to our broadcast, you can email us directly at dyedgreen@heritageradionetwork.org.